I will not try to give Dr. Irwin's talk this morning. I don't know just how he intended to do it, but we will try to cover some phases of the theme with which his morning talk was dedicated, and that is the place of America in the world plan of things. So we're going to start quite a long ways back in the days of the Greek myths. And we're going to realize that from the very earliest periods of Greek culture, there were legends about a mysterious world of the future, a world which was to be a blessed place, a place that lay beyond the boundaries of the sea. We know that the islands of the Hesperides were believed to lie out in the Atlantic Ocean, thousands of miles from the coast of Europe. And these were the lands of the blessed. And at very ancient times, mariners attempted to reach this mysterious world where the golden fleece was hung upon a tree and where all the Argonauts went forth in search of this golden fabric upon which were traced in letters of fire the laws and wills of God. One of the most interesting early records that we have in a little book in the library on the navigations of the Greeks as recorded by Plutarch. According to Plutarch, Greek explorers actually discovered the mouth of the St. Lawrence River and explored part of the territory that is now in the northeastern part of the United States and southern Canada. They took back the legends and stories of their journey. They reported a beautiful and fertile land that had never been ruined or disturbed or destroyed by the sins of mankind. They described in considerable detail the boundaries of this wonderful region. And from the story that they left, a whole group of utopian legends developed. These legends had to do with this wonderful world beyond the sea, where all things were going to be wonderful and beautiful. And in due time, this land, which had been set aside by the gods for the preservation of civilization, was to be a mysterious ark-like vessel into which would flow those of the world who appreciated and understood the real destiny of man, the spiritual problem that man would face, and his victory over the sorrows and iniquities of his environment and the weaknesses of his own nature. Another very interesting legend dealing with this particular problem evolved right here on the Western Hemisphere. We have overlooked many things. If you ask today where democracy began, most people will probably suggest the Swiss Confederation, in which a series of cooperative units, separated by language and by many customs, were able to form a confraternity of social purposes that has continued even to this time. It is said that the theologian André, who is accredited with having actually written the first text of the Rosicrucian manifestos, copied his idea from the Swiss Federation, where there was to be the basis of a universal reformation of human relationships. And he used the idea of the Swiss, in which a group of different nationals were living together in peace and tolerance, as an inspiration towards the larger revolution or restoration which he envisioned. Actually, however, democracy began much earlier. Democracy apparently began here in the Western Hemisphere. It was a birthright of the land itself. It came long before any travelers from other regions established settlements here. There were three great areas in which political and governmental structures were allowed to grow and unfold in the Western Hemisphere. These were North America, Central America and South America. North America was the center of the Indian and Indo-American culture, and probably the most interesting and important of these particular groups was the Great League of the Iroquois Nation. This league was developed and perfected before the arrival of the foreign travelers and colonizers. This league was originally the League of the Five Nations, but later became the League of the Six Nations. And this is the League of Nations, according to historical record, that inspired Woodrow Wilson to formulate the 14 points of his League of Nations. And strangely enough, the land where the idea came from was the one that rejected it. So in the northern hemisphere, we had the Great League of the Iroquois people. And their symbol was the great white cloud of the peace. Their idea was the long house. And the long house was the world. And the sky was the roof, and the earth was the floor. And the wonderful mountains and forests and rivers and lakes were the walls. And here, human beings met in the great peace under the sky. These people had a very interesting series of rules. In the Iroquois League, those who we would call senators today were called sachems. They were the wise ones. And they were elected by the tribes. Now, it is interesting to note that while these sachems were all men, the only ones who could elect them were women. The women did not sit in the lodge, but they selected every one of them by vote, and the men were not allowed to vote. This is quite an interesting thing to happen long ago. Now, when these sachems met together also, they were subject to certain rules. One was that no member of the league could vote for any project affecting his own group. In other words, he could vote for any state except his own. He had to be silent as to anything that would benefit him. He could vote on the benefits of others, but others had to vote on the benefits for him. Another very interesting point is that in the League of the Iroquois, decorum was the order of the day. Decorum was the most important thing of all. When a sachem arose, if the chairman said, "The door is open." Therefore, the sachem or senator was able to give his speech, to tell what he considered to be important and necessary, to bring news, or to ask consideration for special privileges. No one was permitted to interrupt him. When he was through, he sat down. Then it was right for others to speak. But no criticism, no voice of anger, no temper, no conspiracies, no plots, no cartels were permitted under any condition. All relations had to be noble, they had to be gentle, they had to be wise, and they had to be kind. And anyone who broke that rule was thrown out. Now that's something that's rather interesting, starting among Aborigines, who, as one English author said, it was remarkable that this type of government, perhaps the highest form of democracy the world has ever known, came into existence among a group of Indians in blankets and feathers sitting under a tree. Sachems of the Great League went to England as guests of the government later and were received as members of a noble family or as representatives of a noble government. They were always very wise and gentle people. Also, they are the ones who created the concept of the peace belt. The symbol of their league was a group of persons, all holding hands, and it was woven or beaded into wampum. And wherever an Indian messenger went, he carried the peace belt. He could go through any country. He could go through any warring area. He could actually move among enemies of the League. And he would always be respected because he was carrying the symbol of the belt. And incidentally, the Indians made a very special wampum belt for the one white man they learned to trust, William Penn. And the Penn Peace Belt is now in Philadelphia in the museum. And because it was not possible for Penn, who was not an Indian, to go to the Great Peace League in the sky when he left here, where all the nations of the world sat in peace together, he couldn't go into the Indians' happy hunting ground. So they got together and voted in wisdom to build him a little house just outside the gate so that he could watch his friends, the Indians, come and go. Now, this was America in the 15th and 14th centuries, a land where peace was really very important, and where Daganoweda and his disciple, Hiawatha, taught the doctrine of the Great League. Now, further to the south was the double empire of the Aztec and the Maya. And here we had another interesting example. We generally think of the Aztec-Maya Empire as being ruled over by emperors. But in this case, there was a strange similarity between their way of doing it and the practice that was then in vogue in India and Nepal 25 centuries ago. It is true that they had an emperor, but this emperor was not hereditary. He ruled during his own lifetime by election. And when he passed on, he could not nominate a successor. The successor had to be selected by the people and tested, not by the ballot, but by conduct. The new ruler had to have courage. He had to be brave in the presence of adversity. He had to be wise, capable of judging correctly the needs of the people. He had to love the people and take care of them and protect them and prove over a long period of time that he accepted a responsibility for them and not an opportunity for his own advancement. And when he had been checked, proved, and carefully examined and initiated into their religious rites, then he might be installed. But he would always have to be appointed by the people and not by any hereditary group or by any class or caste. As a result of that, we find in the Central American area some very interesting points that perhaps are worth remembering. First of all, that entire civilization never had a medium of exchange. No currency, no money. And yet they built over 60 cities, and many of those cities had populations running into the hundreds of thousands. They never had a wheel. They never had a bow and arrow. But, of course, they did have the glottal, the throwing spear, for protection. But they were very interesting people in many ways. For example, a young person, man or woman, had to accept as part of his birthright that he was the servant of the needs of all the people. He was not allowed to build a career in conflict with the needs of the people. He was not allowed to be competitive in relationship with other people. These things were forbidden him. He had to always consider the common good. He had to maintain the integrity, for any lowering of his own morale or his morality was considered as a desperate danger to the people. He was not permitted to use any alcoholic beverages under any condition until he was 65 years old. Then if he was tired and disillusioned, he could have a drink now and then. but all narcotics were forbidden to him as long as he was able to serve the state. It was only when he retired into private life that he was permitted to have any activity that was not fully justified by the state. So here we had a people that became very much given to architecture, to astronomy. When the Spaniards came over here, they corrected their calendars from the Maya calendar. They were not a group of aborigines, but a very interesting and wonderful people. And the great Florentine Sahagun, a great manuscript relating to the life of these people in the Laurentian Museum Library in Florence, describes a culture that is magnificent in its scope, and yet strangely barbaric, but barbaric with certain simple rules. Be honest. It's perfectly possible for a barbarian to be honest, and it is perfectly possible for a civilized person to be dishonest. So these people live by a very simple but powerful code. Further to the south, the great hierarchy of the Incas in Peru and in that area were very largely politically structured like the Aztecs and the Maya. When Pizarro came into the area to conquer it, he came to a people that had never known war as we know it today. They were not people of war. One day Pizarro said to the Inca, he said, "What do you do with criminals in Peru, in your country?" And the Indian didn't seem to quite understand, so Pizarro explained more carefully that the criminal was the lawbreaker and so on and so on and so on. And the Inca replied, "I don't know what we do with them. We don't have any." On another occasion, when a foreign tribe entered the country, the Peruvians met them with dull weapons, took them without hurting them seriously, made them prisoners, and gave them the right to remain for 5 years under surveillance until it was proven that they were persons of integrity. Then they were given allotments of land and citizenship in the Inca Empire, even though they had come in to invade it. These kind of things were happening here, and they all added together to some of the most interesting factors in the development of our way of life. We have taken much from them, and we could take a little more. Now, from a very early time, the idea of a utopia was strongly fixed in the mind of the people. Plotinus approached the emperor of Rome and asked the emperor to give him a place for a city of the wise. There was an old deserted community on the Campania of Rome, and here he said if they would give him this, he would build a city of wisdom. And the emperor was very much in favor of the idea, and really practically promised Plotinus that he could have his empire, because Plotinus was at that time living in Rome, and he had a reputation so great and so noble that rich Romans left their children in his care and left him to administer the inheritances of their families. Plotinus was therefore hopeful that this great city of the wise could come apart. But when it was presented to the Senate, they turned it down instantly. And the reason they turned it down was very simple. They said very, very definitely, if this city succeeds and wisdom and integrity rules, that's the end for us. So rather than take a chance of losing their own corruptions, they forbade the building or dedication of Platonopolis, the city of the wise. But the dream went on through More's Utopia, through Bacon's New Atlantis. And in Bacon we find the summarizing of the whole concept, the New Atlantis, which is America. And here, from a very early time, from the first navigations of Columbus and those who followed him, there was the realization that this continent had been set aside by a power beyond that of man to provide the homeland of a united people bound together, as Gandhi said, by nothing stronger than the silken thread of love. That here was to be the great experiment. Here was the place in which the great involutionary processes of nations would be reversed and a great evolutionary process would set in. That opportunities and privileges and rights, that a clean earth free from the conspiracies of Europe would be able to accomplish that which was necessary. The Hindus have records of the ancient will of the gods on these matters. We hear the stories of the secret governments behind the government of the earth, that the spiritual laws that must be fulfilled in the due course of time, and that the fate of mankind finally does not rest completely in the hands of men, but in the hands of the divine plan, which man must ultimately learn to accept and obey. So there have been all kinds of interesting accounts flowing into what would constitute the Western paradise of Amitabha. This was the Buddhist concept, the paradise of the West, the Western world, that which lay beyond the mountains, beyond the great oceans. And we are told that the Seminoles of Florida originally believed and affirmed definitely that there was a land bridge between Europe and America at a very ancient time. That this land bridge was probably the lost continent of Atlantis. Now, the Atlanteans seemingly had certain concepts that were important. But as Plato points out, they rose against the truth. They destroyed themselves by the corruption of knowledge. They created a scientific empire, and their own sciences destroyed them. And this was the record that was kept in the subterranean caves and grottos in Egypt under the temple of Isis at Sais. There was the story of the land that destroyed itself by losing its own virtues, by corrupting its own ways. But also Plato told us that there was a great navigation, a great mercantile between Atlantis and the other parts of the then known world. The Atlantean traders and merchants traveled into most distant places with very reliable and suitable ships and carried goods and merchandise with them for trade and barter. Now it seems there is a possibility worth remembering that these merchants were not too different from merchants later. We know, for example, that when the Etruscans and the Near Eastern peoples entered into a trade with Western Europe, that their ships came along the coast of Europe into Great Britain and onto the coast of France, and that in doing so they left a great deal of the ancient beliefs and wisdoms of their people on the Western Hemisphere, on the European Hemisphere. So that we have given a thought to the idea that the Atlantean navigators very probably brought with them some colonizers. They traded, they did various things, but they also brought missionaries. They brought the same kind of traveler that we find in modern times. When a country opens another country to commerce, they send educators, they send all kinds of people, doctors and ministers, to advance the cultures of these new neighbors that they have made. Now, at some remote time, this seemingly happened in connection with the Atlantean distribution of land. For in this time, it would seem that these navigators landed on various areas and established centers of their own culture. Every nation of importance has the same origin legends, identical in every respect, that a great time passed, which men have no longer the memory of, ships dragons, boats, mysterious flying monsters came out of the sea. And from these came forth founders and creators of nations. And they came ashore, and they set up various colonies in the area where this navigation existed. In the case of the Aztec Maya complex, we are told that out of the sea came a raft of serpents, which was probably a boat. And on this raft was a mysterious elder, Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. And he was a strange person, but he was not an Indian. He was probably as described as a light-complexioned person. He wore long robes and a great feathered bonnet, and on his robes were crosses, and he carried a crozier in his hand. And he came ashore near what is now Veracruz, and he taught the people. He gave them instructions in agriculture. He taught them medicine and art. He taught them the laws by which they could build a permanent culture. He gave them a written language, and he also gave them the rules of architecture, husbandry, and all of the learned cultures, including music, poetry, and literature. And having established a firm government, he then went back into the sea. He called for the raft of serpents, and it came back. And he, before he left, he turned to the people and said, "Take care of the things I have given you, and I will come back and rule over you again." So they kept the word, but he never came back. Instead of that came Cortes, much later. But when Montezuma knew that the ships of Cortes had arrived off the coast of Mexico, he sent messengers carrying with them the bonnet of the emperor, because he thought it was Quetzalcoatl returning. And he told his messengers to tell that he had kept the rules that had been given to him, and he was ready to turn over the empire to Quetzalcoatl. It was this misunderstanding that, with its tragic consequences, that contributed considerably to the fall of Mexico, so far as the native population was concerned. On the other side of the world, in Chaldea and Babylonia, there rose out of the sea a mysterious being, Oannes the fishman. This man came from somewhere beyond the oceans, and he walked upon the land, and he had a body of a human being and the head of a fish. I might remind you that the bishop's mitre is the head of a fish. And this being taught the people. He gave them the language. He taught them medicine and art. He taught them agriculture. He taught exactly the same things that Quetzalcoatl had taught to the Western Hemisphere. He also returned to the sea and said he would return, but he never came back. Now, it is believed by some, at least, that these were from the Atlantean continent. They were civilizers from that mysterious land that vanished away, according to the Codex Torano, taking 60 million people to death in a single night. The reason they never came back was because they had been destroyed. But at the same time, there seems to be a great distribution of culture that traces back all the way to the Atlantean period, in which the foundations of civilization, as we know them, have their footings and bases. Now, after the gradual development of a concept of the Western world, after the voyages of Drake and the voyages of Columbus and Magellan and all these travelers, the new land began to open up as a great center of future world culture. At about the same time, there were rumblings in Europe of the impossibility of developing a permanent, unified culture in Europe. Europe was locked in wars from the Crusades to the Hundred Years' War and the 30 Years' War. It was all conflict and struggle between small, petty despots to control the common people. One of the most interesting of the people of that time, as far as the utopians were concerned, was André, the Lutheran theologian. He lived through three different periods in which his home, his libraries, and everything that he had were destroyed by war. We find war, therefore, the great enemy. But somehow, for one reason or another, there were also rising prophets. And these prophets have always existed. From as Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel in the Old Testament, to the mysterious prophecies of the Apocalypse, to the various prophecies of non-Christian peoples all over the world. There have been a series of revelations that have been very difficult to define or to explain. We find the prophecies of Paracelsus, a sober physician, who also had a vision of the shape of things to come. All over the world, we have these different realizations, like that of Nostradamus. One way or another, the message came through that there was a plan for the Western Hemisphere. This plan probably was known also to the Mongols under Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, because Kublai Khan was trading horses with the princes of the Medici family. Asia was not as far away then as it has been later. And it was also there that in China the emperor had the vision of the golden being that was going to come and bring peace to the world. The Taoists of China believed there was a paradise to where good souls went and lived forever in peace. They called it the Paradise of the West. This Paradise of the West sort of built up a reputation for itself, a reputation of beauty, of wonder, of unspoiled land, of common kindness, and of peace and freedom from all of the stress and emergencies of European life. There's no doubt in the world that the founding fathers of this country were at least in part aware of the older stories, because they were on everyone's lips in those days, as strange tales are now constantly repeated and disseminated. There is no doubt in the world that a plan was instituted by means of which it was hoped that the mysterious powers behind our normal way of life were guiding this nation to its full destiny. Now, the interruptions and sorrows of this situation have also been carefully mentioned. We know the vision of Lincoln and his own realization that his destiny had come. Lincoln definitely realized or believed that he was there for a purpose, and that purpose fulfilled, he saw the black ship that would carry him away forever. There was the rough prophecy that was written the day of the birth of George Washington, telling through the problems and the difficulties of the nation. There is also the story of the prophecy of Valley Forge, where George Washington saw the future of the country, saw the great trials through which it would pass, but realized that it would emerge triumphantly in the end. There was Macmillan's dream, dream of the American general. And there was another dream or two, not only from these formal sources, but from other little quiet people who have had visions again and again. Visions of the saints, of the mystics, of the seers. Visions that came to people like Andrew Jackson Davis and Baron Emanuel Swedenborg. From the inside of man himself, there seemed to be constantly emerging visions, dreams, and hopes, which he believed should someday be brought together to form a new way of life for people in this world. And now, as the result of so many of these older plans, the carefully laid foundations that were some of them built 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, we have come to our present emergency, an emergency which, strangely enough, seems to be really unnecessary. An emergency in which a people educated, cultured, skillful, a people basically of good intention, have managed to bind themselves into a turmoil, into a crisis, and into a criticism. Yet we are still informed by the scriptures of old and by the mystic yearnings of the sages that this situation will not prevail against the common good, that the purpose of the great brotherhood that guides the world is that this nation shall survive. This situation will not prevail against the common good, that the purpose of the great brotherhood that guides the world is that this nation shall survive. It shall survive because it was destined. And it shall survive because that which put it in motion is stronger than anything that can be used against it. But in this moment or this time of stress and trial, it is very important that there must be, a growing and enlarging realization of the essential purpose for which this nation was founded. It is no longer simply to be considered as another adventure in competition and conspiracy. Now, for a long time, we opened our gates here to emigration from other countries. The tired, the weary, the persecuted, the underprivileged came here. And gradually out of this, we have developed a strange melting pot. And in the last 10 years, this melting pot has gained more momentum, and millions are coming here from disturbed and persecuted areas of the earth. Now, to many people, and to probably quite a few thoughtful persons, this influx is a problem. It represents a hazard. It becomes something that we have to cope with. But it also can very well mean that we are continuing to build up what might be termed an international nation. We are building up gradually through the years a concept somewhat like that of the Swiss, of peoples of all groups, all backgrounds, all races, being able to unite for the great purpose of fulfilling the destiny of the human being, rather than merely the political contrivances of physical leadership. So we have here now more and more a representative group of persons, that some of them are still not assimilated. Some do not even know what it is all about. Some of them are going to be very troublesome. But the plan of things seems to indicate to us that the answer in the end will be what is deemed to be right. The good will come. This is not, as Simón Bolívar said before the great Latin American patriot, he said, America is not a country. America is an assignment of destiny. Now, people don't think much of assignments of destiny. We are all gravely troubled. We are all worried and frightened by situations which we find beyond our control. But if we are correct, and I believe we are, that there is a destiny that is beyond our own keeping, that man has the right to make mistakes, but he does not have the right to destroy himself, that no matter what happens, all things work together for good. Something, the greatest good of all, comes from the greatest labor of all. The greatest security is the result of overcoming the greatest insecurity. All the way along, we have had leadership that was wise and leadership that was not wise. But we gradually are beginning to wake up ourselves little by little, this country is beginning to take on the measure of its own destiny. It is beginning to think in terms of what the individual himself must do. It becomes more and more a matter of the fact that insecurity is causing us to restore the inner values of our lives. We have made a mistake, a bad one. We have believed that security was in the world, when in reality security is in the heart and the soul. There can be no security except that which can be earned or manifested from within the depth of ourselves. And we are being tempered and by a fire of adversity, but we are not going to be destroyed. We are gradually going to find the answer that we know is an answer founded in religion, founded in spiritual values, in integrities, in morality, and in ethics. And we see this gradually developing right now in this world. Millions of people who not long ago had very little but superficial thoughts are now beginning to sense the importance of investigating, considering, enlarging, and improving their own inner lives and making new and gracious dedications to the common good. So out of the worst problem, we can perhaps come to what one of the old statements that was made, namely, that the greatest sinner makes the greatest saint. And we ought to be pretty sanctified pretty soon now. We ought to be well aware that contrary to general opinion, innocence and virtue are not the same thing. Innocence is ignorance, weakness. The individual who is right because he doesn't know what right and wrong are. But with man, as Aquinas tells us, with his definite power of choice, innocence must gradually give way to suffering. And suffering, in turn, must give way to virtue. The end of all our striving is the transformation of ignorance into virtue. We must gradually strengthen character and escape from the tendency to regard our world as something that is more important than the perfection of our own natures. Worldliness is gradually coming to an end. We are not going to be able to maintain it much longer. Worldliness is the individual investing his hopes, his beliefs, his fears and his securities in material things, the most fragile and impermanent of all. There is no permanence in this world. There is no permanence in the institutions that we build. Many of them do not even last as long as we do. There is no security in this material state of things. Security consists of the unfoldment of eternals and principles within ourselves. This unfoldment is now being stimulated as never before in history. We have never been in an emergency before in which it was more necessary to make constructive decisions. We may not make them immediately. We may have some more suffering to go through. But the plan of the ages will not be defeated. And that which we have suffered so long to learn is not going to be lost. According to our belief in reincarnation, the individual has lived long and many times to get as far as he has now. He has suffered much in growth already. He has gone through many tragedies, some of which are recorded on the pages of history, and others are recorded only on the tablets of the soul. But he has gone through much. He has struggled through all kinds of sorrows and tragedies and misfortunes. He has been victimized many times. He has victimized himself many times. But through it all, he has come to now. And this long journey is not going to be frustrated. It may take time before the internal is strong enough to control the external. But that's what has been building up since the beginning, man's gradual victory over the weaknesses in himself. And this victory must continue until it is accomplished. Our patriots in this country and in other countries also, those who have tried to lead their people into a better way of life, have never had it easy. The great Latin American liberator whom we mentioned before, Simon Bolivar, died of a broken heart in a borrowed nightshirt in a bed that did not belong to him. It has been very hard, but it is better to recognize that if that failure in the cause of something that must ultimately succeed is better than success in a cause that must ultimately fail. So in this emergency, men and people are beginning to turn towards a philosophy of life that we have always had, but for a long time we paid little attention to it. In the Orient, this was called the Arhat or Lohan or Rishi tradition, the esoteric schools of the East. In Europe and the West, it has been referred